From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Bush administration is under siege.
What did the president know, and when did he know it? What did he know about it?
Knowledgeable sources say that Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, does not plan any announcement in the case this week.
Legal analysts believe it means Fitzgerald will likely present his evidence through criminal indictment.
Time magazine reports senior White House advisor Karl Rove plans to resign or take an unpaid leave if he's indicted in the CIA leak case.
The conventional wisdom inside the Beltway and beyond is that this week at least one and possibly two senior White House officials will be indicted for crimes related to the Valerie Plame affair. U.S. News and World Report published rumors that, never mind Karl Rove and I. Lewis Libby, Vice President Cheney's head might roll. So, let's talk about Judith Miller. She is the New York Times reporter who has become the story within the story about who outed CIA Officer Plame and why. 2 weeks ago, after serving 85 days in jail on contempt charges for refusing to testify before a grand jury, Miller finally relented, whereupon all that had been so murky in the case became murkier still. The latest chapter actually began last month with a note from Miller's source, Vice Presidential aide Scooter Libby, releasing her from her pledge of confidentiality. This release was materially no different from the one he offered a year ago, an offer Miller and the Times deemed coerced. But this time she was satisfied. Maybe it was the 3 months in custody, or maybe it was Libby's prose. "Out west where you vacation," he wrote, "the aspens will already be turning. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them. Come back to work and life." Their roots connect them? Has he been reading too much Deepak Chopra, or was it a secret message?
It's weird enough that you don't dismiss out of hand the notion that it was some sort of code. We've come so far that you can't even dismiss that out of hand.
Times reporter Adam Liptak has been covering the Plame affair for 2 years, a beat that earned him the bonus of working on last Sunday's 6,000-word New York Times investigation of the New York Times conduct in the Plame affair, a story accompanied by a 3,000-word mea non culpa from Judy Miller herself.
The piece was completely unsatisfactory. And then her attitude that she would not answer further questions on that subject matter was just as unsatisfactory. The piece was heavily lawyered, which is an unusual thing for a journalist's work to do. That is, her lawyers read and revised the piece before it was published. I think that's a deeply questionable practice.
But her guardedness turned out to be pointless in the face of her first-person story, itself in several ways a jaw-dropping self-indictment. For all the lawyering, Miller's piece revealed glaring journalistic crimes of precisely the sort that made her a controversial figure in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, when her ominous reporting on Saddam's supposed weapons of mass destruction bolstered the administration's rationale for war.
She was a woman on a mission and was very difficult to control.
Journalist Seth Mnookin is author of Hard News, a book about the Times he researched in the middle of Miller's WMD reporting. He was as stunned as anyone by revelations from her own piece, among them that while in embed in Iraq, she agreed to a degree of secrecy about what she learned there, far beyond the routine we-won't-disclose-operational-details promises demanded of all reporters.
That's an extremely, extremely bizarre and unique situation. As a reporter, I would have difficulty accepting that type of arrangement.
That means she was clearing stuff with the Army.
Alan Wolper is the ethics columnist for Editor and Publisher magazine.
There's never a circumstance where you're signing up to enlist in the Army at the expense of your readers and your editors. There's no such thing.
Wolper is equally appalled by Miller's description of protecting Scooter Libby by agreeing to identify him not as an anonymous senior White House official, but as a former Capitol Hill staffer. While Libby did once upon a time work on the Hill, the misdirection would have clearly violated the Times' explicit policy on sourcing, not to mention the reader's trust.
It misrepresents who the person was that they were speaking to, and therefore the reader doesn't know. The reason that you give a person anonymity in journalism is so that that person is not fired, they're not killed, their children aren't dragged off somewhere.
So why are you protecting your source that way? Because you want to be able to go back to that source again and again and again.
Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor Christopher Dickey, who reported alongside Miller in Libya and elsewhere, believes this and her other glaring excesses were rooted in her compulsion to maintain access to the corridors of power. Access, he says, can be addictive.
And it's often destructive, because her great virtue, and I guess in some ways her great failing, is that she was always able to get very close to the people at the pinnacle of power in any story that she was covering. And she tended to listen to what they had to say, convey what they had to say, and maybe not question as much or at all what they were saying. And frankly, I think that's why the New York Times tried many times to pair her up with somebody else. She would get the access. She would get the pointed bits of information. And other reporters would be there trying to figure out if it was true or not.
Dickey is quick to point out that the lust for inside sources and the uncritical reporting of their pronouncements is hardly unique to Judy Miller. It is endemic in modern reporting, especially in these days when resources for slow-cooked, triple-checked investigative journalism are dwindling. But it was Times executive editor Hal Raines who told Judy Miller to, quote, go out and win a Pulitzer, without paying strict attention as to how she went about it. Raines, of course, is no longer executive editor. He fell on his sword for the Jason Blair scandal and other high-profile embarrassments. The current boss is Bill Keller, who commissioned Sunday's pieces, at least in part, to quell the trash talk about his paper. Last week, when it became apparent that the 9,000-word package raised as many questions as it answered, he emailed his staff from China. When I get back, he wrote, I'll still have some important loose ends to tie up from this episode.
He's probably not talking about, you know, emptying out his coffee cups and returning his email.
Author Seth Mnookin.
I suspect that the resolution we'll see from this is that in one way or another, she will not be writing for the New York Times again.
Another loose end might be explaining how, as revealed last Sunday, the Times spent millions of dollars and all of its prestige defending Miller's stance without knowing whether Scooter Libby did or did not, by name, out CIA Officer Plame. No doubt Keller was surprised that Miller cooled her heels in jail for 85 days only to testify, I don't remember.
That's likely one of the things that Bill Keller is going to need to address with his staff is why was it that the paper went down this road, this very public, very expensive, very traumatic road, and it seems that the two top executives did not have full knowledge of what the situation was.
But then who did? In maybe the most bizarre manifestation of journalistic translucency, a story in last Monday's Times parsed the revelations reported in last Sunday's Times. This isn't journalism, it's an M.C. Escher print, infinitely turning back on itself. Adam Liptak.
It's very difficult to report on your own institution and on your own superiors, and I think that if most major American institutions were to say to the world, if, you know, whether it's General Motors or an accounting firm or anybody else, you know, take our word for it, we're going to get to the bottom of this on your behalf, the ordinary reaction would be laughter.
Yep, because Scooter Libby was right. No matter how proud and solitary seem the towering aspens, underneath the roots are connected. Editors, editing reporters, reporting about other reporters and their two intimate sources. It's all too connected to disentangle. And maybe it's why, as November approaches, these aspens are all turning the same sick shade of yellow.
And now, letters. Our interview with Frederick Kaufman, in which he likened the Food Channel to pornography, got a lot of you very steamed up. Frank Baker's view is representative of the nays. This is the most disgusting report I have ever heard from NPR, he wrote. In my opinion, Kaufman has a serious sex problem. While I have problems with the Food Channel's format and content, it is certainly not pornographic. I hold NPR responsible for bad programming and content. I expect and demand better. And standing in for all the yays, Bob Mitchell from Bear, Delaware, wrote this.
I heard Frederick Hoffman's comparison of the Food Network to pornography today on WHYY-FM. It sounded more like Howard Stern than NPR. I loved it. Please keep it up. Pun intended.
We also got a letter about the interview I did last week with Nick Gillespie from Reason Magazine about covering meth, a conversation in which Gillespie took Newsweek to task, among other news organizations, for overhyping drug coverage. Newsweek's editor, Mark Whitaker, complained, properly, that we neglected to verify Gillespie's charge. He writes, "Without bothering to check the story, you let a commentator claim that Newsweek's recent cover on methamphetamines contained no statistics to substantiate our assertion that it's an epidemic. In fact, the fourth paragraph of the story begins as follows. More than 12 million Americans have tried methamphetamine, and 1.5 million are regular users, according to federal estimates. Meth-making operations have been uncovered in all 50 states. Missouri tops the list with more than 8,000 labs, equipment caches, and toxic dumps seized between 2002 and 2004. In a survey of 500 law enforcement agencies in 45 states released last month by the National Association of Counties, 58% said meth is their biggest drug problem." Whitaker continues, "If your mission is to monitor the accuracy of what is being reported in the media, shouldn't you take the time to do some reporting on what you allow people to say on your show?"
Keep your letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, especially if you edit a magazine we unfairly criticize. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, a mind-blowing tale of drugs, terrorists, authors, and flax.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here is a story so twisted and tangled the truth may never see the light of day. It begins in a time, that is to say now, when interest groups, industries, and even the White House shun overt public relations. That's why advertisers prefer to place their products inside sitcoms rather than run ads. That's why the Bush administration paid columnists to push No Child Left Behind. And that's why someone came up with the idea that the drug lobby would benefit from a novel that had terrorists tampering with generic drugs from Canada. Mark Barrandes, a consultant to the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA, liked the idea. He believes that, under current laws, terrorist tampering with foreign generics is a real concern, and thought that a good thriller could drive that message home.
If you bring in terrorism experts and they're testifying, you know, people just get ho-hum. They don't really catch on to it. But if it's put into a colorful situation where it shows that this is something that's potentially harmful and might have an impact on your life, even though it's fictional, it gets you thinking a little bit.
And who at PhRMA did you take this idea to?
She is a lower-level individual that had the ability to agree that this is something that we could explore.
So they commissioned a book to be written by first-time novelists Julie Kristen and Kenan Spivak, who describes the plot as commissioned by the PhRMA rep.
A group of Bosnian Muslims who were unhappy with the fact that the United States was not supporting Bosnian Muslims against Serbs, launched an attack using tainted drugs on Americans through the Canadian website pharmacies, and many thousands of Americans died.
Spivak said he chafed under the demand that they dumb down the book to appeal to women who buy more drugs than men, and that all the terrorists be religious fanatics. But he and his writing partner delivered the goods, promptly rejected by Barrandus and the pharma employee, on the grounds that it was transparent drivel with the potential to backfire.
A child in the fifth grade could have written better than the document that I was handed, and we thought someone might think that this was some improper conduct on the part of the pharmaceutical industry of trying to scare someone.
Someone did think that. The pharma leadership, Senior Vice President Ken Johnson.
This was a screwball idea. You know, we have credible safety-based arguments supporting our position against importation, but we're not in the business of publishing pulp fiction and Looney Tunes.
But someone from your organization was clearly in touch with this publisher, and there were payments made.
Not by pharma.
That money was money that I paid over to them.
Pharma consultant Mark Barrandus.
I, as a consultant, paid to have a draft of this manuscript prepared.
Not only did Barrandus, a lawyer, pay to prepare the manuscript, he also tried to pay $100,000 to kill it, co-author Kenan Spivak.
For this $100,000, they wanted the publisher, my co-author, and me to agree for the rest of our lives, publicly and privately, to never say anything critical of the pharmaceutical industry, pharma, or the lawyer.
They said unless we paid them a certain amount of money, they were going to write the book and hold the pharmaceutical industry out in a negative light.
It sounds like you're accusing them of blackmail.
That's about what it was. But, you know, we have nothing to be blackmailed about. It was a bad idea, and it was acknowledged to be a bad idea. That's it. I mean, people make mistakes.
They say that it was stipulated that if they accepted the 100 grand, they weren't to say anything critical of the pharmaceutical industry for the rest of their lives.
That's incorrect. What it had was a general non-denigration clause that I put into all contracts. And I think in this particular case, I may have added an extra paragraph about something to do with the pharmaceutical industry because of the vindictive nature that I sensed in them by the original threat.
Beware of lawyers bearing additional paragraphs. That one flew right up Spivak's nose. He and his co-author rejected the money. Did you think it was a pretty good book you delivered? A ripping good yarn?
I thought it was what they wanted. I think what they wanted was not a terrific book. I think the book that now exists is a terrific book.
If they think that they've fixed it up, then see if you would read it. I bet you, by the time that you get to the third chapter, you'll be pulling out Dramamine because your head will be spinning.
And you can buy that over the counter. But Spivak and Kristen did rewrite the novel, retaining some of the old terrorists and adding a big, fat new one.
There's also now a subplot involving a large pharmaceutical company, which concerned that terrorist attacks might help color the Americans' perception of imported drugs. This pharmaceutical company decides to launch a real terrorist attack on its own.
Oh, my God. So, for revenge, you've made the enemy the big drug companies themselves.
Well, one of the two enemies is the big drug company. And interestingly, one of the requests made by pharma while we were writing the book was that the motive be greed. And we really couldn't figure out how to have the type of crazy fundamentalist Muslim terrorists they wanted have as their motive greed. But there's no such problem in looking at a pharmaceutical company as a terrorist.
Consultant Mark Barrandus.
Clearly, Spivak is trying to market through you. That's all that this is about. I've got no dog in this fight. I'm giving you the honest account of what took place.
You're still a consultant for pharma, right?
Yes, I am.
Oh, it's a sordid tale. Not the novel, the real-life story, where to hear it, everyone is a victim. Especially, and I may have to reach for the Dramamine here, the big drug lobby. Pharma Senior Vice President Ken Johnson.
We have taken strong internal steps to correct this problem. It's not going to happen again. But again, it was one person, in effect, a renegade. And, you know, I don't think that people hold the New York Times to blame for all of the mistakes of Jason Blair.
Well, actually, people do. And one more thing. The publisher who took on the novel assigned one of his recent authors as editor, but he reportedly got into a fight with one of the authors and was quickly let go. The name of that editor? Get out the Dramamine. It was Jason Blair. The final version of the novel, The Karasik Conspiracy, is due out in December, but just to be clear, we're not advising you to buy it. This week, historian Alvin M. Josephi Jr. died. His obituaries emphasized his scholarly work about Native Americans, but what caught our eye was the part Josephi played in World War II. As one of a handful of combat journalists in the Marine Corps, Josephi lugged heavy, primitive sound equipment into battles, making recordings that played on the evening news, bringing the war to the people back home. WNYC historian Andy Lancet archives everything, and he dug out an interview he did with Josephi a few years back. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Brooke.
So 15 years ago, you spoke with Josephi about his 1944 landing on Guam. And at the beginning of the tape, he mentioned something called the half track and a CB. What are those?
Well, a half track, as I understand it, is an amphibious or quasi-amphibious vehicle which took the soldiers from the big ship onto shore.
And a CB?
A CB is a helper. He's part of the Marines.
Now, in the tape, he describes this recording equipment, and he talks about a tape, and he refers to a needle.
The recorders were record graph machines, and they used what they called ammer-type film. And we're looking at something that runs like a 35-millimeter film strip. And the needle was in a fixed position, and I believe Josephi will tell you the rest.
It was a very ingenious machine. It's not in existence anymore. But the great asset was that the needle was in a fixed head, so it couldn't be jarred by any kinds of explosion or anything else. That was in the well of the half track, and I had 40 feet of wire and a hand microphone, and I had a condom wrapped over the microphone to keep salt water out of it, because when we hit the lip of the reef, I was going to get out and wade with the men. And about 26 of the 32 men in our little landing boat were hit crossing the reef.
How is it that the Marines ended up with this equipment to begin with?
Well, the gear came to them initially from the Library of Congress because the music division at the time, the head of the music division, thought, well, they're in the islands in the Pacific. Let's get that folk music. Let's get the people singing. The Marine Corps had other plans. They wanted a way to help publicize what their guys were doing on the front lines. And, I mean, as well, they fulfilled their end of the bargain.
They delivered some folk music?
They did indeed.
So how many recordings ended up at the Library of Congress from this Marine Corps experiment?
Well, from what I understand, there are about 2,000 recordings, and of that, it makes up about 500 hours of material.
Now, you have some of the recordings that Josephi made under battle conditions in a foxhole. And you talked about that when you spoke to him 15 years ago, about how he came to make that recording. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Well, this fellow Wheaton, the CB, and I dug a two-man foxhole. So one could sleep for 2 hours or an hour or whatever, and the other stay awake. And I had the recording gear. I usually would put it right next to my head, and the hand microphone next to me. And I went to sleep and was sleeping on my back. And Wheaton suddenly began to nudge me. And then I came awake and I heard all kinds of noises going on. Marine, you die. They were screaming. The Japanese were yelling. And then they came down. They came rushing down from the top of the hill, mobs of them. And I was trying to stay very quiet because I didn't want them to find our foxhole. I didn't know what was going on. So I had this hand microphone pressed right against my mouth, and I was speaking into it. And when you do that, you speak very slowly and try to enunciate everything so it gets in there clearly. And it sounds like I'm being operated on or something, you know.
Now, I would like to be able to speak louder and with more clarity. But unfortunately, the slightest noise, the slightest rustle will draw fire, not only from the Japanese, who are someplace around us, but from our own Marines who are huddled nearby in foxholes like this one.
Giuseppe kept recording from battle to battle. He ended up on Iwo Jima. He was awarded the Bronze Star. He definitely was someone who you had a sense had really had his wits about him and could have survived well under such dire circumstances.
All right, Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
WNYC archivist Andy Lancet.
When Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, radio stations in the area were devastated along with everything else. But an unprecedented collaboration emerged from the wreckage. Within hours of the storm, rival radio conglomerates, Clear Channel and Entercom, had formed the United Radio Broadcasters of New Orleans, 75 miles from the Big Easy in Baton Rouge. It's been going 24/7 ever since. KERA's Bill Siebel reports.
In New Orleans, 50,000-watt WWL 870 AM is the designated station for emergency information. It's a top-rated broadcaster in the Crescent City with conservative talk stars like Rush Limbaugh and a local team of reporters. Dave Cohen is the news director, who's worked at the Entercom powerhouse for 8 years.
We stayed on the air throughout the storm. Of our 6 Entercom stations, at all times, at least 4 were on the air.
Eventually, though, they had to evacuate. Katrina thrashed every broadcaster in town, but Clear Channel, with its 7 New Orleans stations and deep corporate pockets, had options. Dick Lewis, Clear Channel's regional vice president, evacuated personnel to the company's Baton Rouge office. He hired a helicopter to fly technicians into New Orleans to fix a transmitter.
And then used the helicopter to ferry people out. And then the flooding broke out and the civil disobedience. My fear was that we would have people dead. Did everything that we could possibly do to get them out, and we got everybody out.
By then, says Lewis, Clear Channel and Entercom executives had decided the only way to keep broadcasting vital emergency information was to work together. Entercom's WWL had the New Orleans news operation. Clear Channel, with only music stations in the Crescent City, had studios in Baton Rouge. The competitors turned partners in a mission that became intensely personal.
It's one of the more unusual things where television, they want to be the exclusive reporter. Radio, we're different. This is about the lady who called in the middle of the night and said, I couldn't get 911 to answer. I'm in the attic with my babies. The water's rising. Can you get me help? We had the Louisiana State Police stationed in our building. We carried that information and that address to them. They took it to the National Guard. We don't know that the lady was saved or not, but we know that we were the place that she turned to for help, and we did all that we knew how to do.
The partnership now airs on WWL, with other Entercom and Clear Channel stations simulcasting some of the information.
United Radio Broadcasters of New Orleans, a service of the Big 870 WWL, FM 98.5 WILD, Entercom Communications, and Clear Channel Radio.
I'm not feeling anyone saying, all right, you do music, we do news, let us take the lead.
Monica St. Pierre works at WQUE in New Orleans, Clear Channel's hip-hop and R&B station. She says the partnership is working.
And I've seen people who were music jocks rise to the occasion. I've seen people who weren't talk show hosts get from behind the scenes and get on the air and rise to the occasion. So there are times when it's bigger than any one person. You know what you have to do.
It's beyond a job. It's beyond a job.
Jeff Momus is WWL's executive producer.
People tell you from everywhere, from the politicians to the police to your listeners who say, you saved us.
Momus was producing when New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin called the show.
Every day that we delay, people are dying. This is ridiculous. And I don't want to see anybody do any more goddamn press conferences. Don't do another press conference until the resources are in this city. Don't tell me 40,000 people are coming here. They're not here.
Clear Channel's Dick Lewis thinks numerous rebroadcasts of Nagin's appearance is part of the reason President Bush has been to the Crescent City more than half a dozen times. In the weeks since Katrina, United Broadcasters has continued taking calls from hurricane victims, hosting numerous officials, and running public service announcements, from insurance information to job opportunities. Lewis is also convinced none of this would have happened without FCC rule changes a decade ago that let one company own many stations in a market.
It's because of the consolidation that Clear Channel and Intercom have the resources to do this. If it were as it was prior to consolidation, and we were all small, independent companies, we'd be off the air, we'd be bankrupt, we'd be gone.
There are valid criticisms and debates to be had over allowing one company to own so many radio stations.
Again, WWL News Director Dave Cohen.
But in this case, there's no way this could have happened. No way had we not had two big media companies that owned this many radio stations.
Clear Channel's Dick Lewis expects the cost of United Broadcasters to reach into the millions once the accountants go over the books. 300 people now crowd the Baton Rouge office that used to hold 100. And mobile homes in the field next door house displaced New Orleans staff. Meanwhile, revenue has dropped to zero since most ads have been replaced by public service announcements. But despite the mounting costs, Lewis says there's no talk of pulling the plug on United Broadcasters.
There is no clock. There is no calendar. Serve the public. Save the people.
In recent years, big radio conglomerates have come under fire on Capitol Hill. Clear Channel especially had become almost a poster child for the perils of media consolidation. WWL's Dave Cohen applauds the public spirit exhibited by Entercom and Clear Channel, which acted so quickly to provide a crucial service. But he also notes that those companies surely would have factored in all that priceless goodwill and the likelihood that generosity now will pay big dividends later. For On the Media, I'm Bill Zeeble.
Coming up, the networks give up on Saturday nights. And in the Middle East, Ramadan means a month of must-see TV.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last weekend, in her first tournament as a golf professional, 16-year-old sensation Michelle Wee finished fourth in the Samsung World Championship. That is, until someone notified a tournament official that in Saturday's third day of competition, Wee may have broken a rule of golf. The official determined that in dropping a ball to replace one in an unplayable lie, Wee did indeed let it fall closer to the green than the unplayable shot. For that infraction, she should have given herself a two-stroke penalty. But because she signed her scorecard without assessing that penalty, she was disqualified. Such episodes happen from time to time in professional golf. The twist here is that the person who notified tournament officials about the infraction was a reporter covering the tournament, Sports Illustrated's Michael Bamberger. His editor, Jim Harry, says the situation arose out of golf's unique approach to enforcing its rules.
In the rules of golf, everyone is an official. It's up to the players themselves and everyone who is watching the competition to referee it. The rules officials are reactive. They're there to advise, not to watch the players.
As far as you know, is this the first time that a journalist has been, excuse the expression, snitch?
Yes, I believe it is.
Okay, now in golf, everybody is the referee. But as a matter of sort of journalistic principles, except in life or death situations, the reporter allows the rest of the people to be the referees and tries to stay above the fray. Is golf reporting such a different beast that the ordinary journalistic principle doesn't apply?
Golf is such a different game that the rules that are applied to other sports do not apply to golf. I think that's the great debate about this, whether a journalist can act like a spectator could act or like a television viewer could act. And I would argue, under the spirit of the rules, yes. And we're very comfortable with the decision that we made. We felt it was the only thing we could do.
You're comfortable with your decision, and yet, if you could, you know, turn back time, how would this have all played out?
Wouldn't that be lovely? In hindsight, what we could have done on Saturday is alert a rules official while Michelle was still on the course, and then what they would have done is review the incident on the seventh hole before she signed her scorecard. Now, if we had done that, if we would have alerted the officials immediately, she would have been given a two-stroke penalty and not be disqualified. However, our dilemma at the time was that we weren't sure. We hadn't looked at any tapes. We hadn't scientifically measured the drop. We hadn't asked Michelle Wee about the drop or anyone. And we felt at that time it was inappropriate to act like police. We weren't there to police the event. We thought we saw something, but we weren't certain. It was only the next day after doing due diligence that we became
police.
Because we
blew the whistle.
We blew the whistle, that's right.
You have taken a whole mess of grief from your journalistic colleagues. Is it that your colleagues don't sufficiently understand the rules and the spirit of the game of golf? Or is it that you guys don't sufficiently understand the rules and spirit of journalism?
Journalists should not be part of the story. That's the mantra, is it not? We know that. I've been in this business for 31 years. Frankly, I find your question insulting.
No insult intended. I got to tell you, the reason we're doing this is not because we sat there in our meeting on Monday and said, man, this guy crossed the line. It's totally wrong. It's obvious. The reporter never intrudes on the story. Because of the rules of golf, what I liked about the story and the reason I was pushing for it was because it was sort of an irresistible force against an immovable object. From a certain perspective, he did exactly the right thing. And from a certain perspective, he did exactly the wrong thing. And I'm trying to decide, you know, where the ultimate truth lies.
Well, I think you have a good handle on it. It is a dilemma. Now, what if we would have written, without going to tour officials, here's what we saw. We saw Michelle Wee take an improper drop on Saturday. Say it came to light on Tuesday or Wednesday when our magazine is published. How would you feel about us after reading that story? And wouldn't you ask, well, why didn't you say something at the time? That's what everyone in golf would have said.
All right, Jim. Thank you for talking to us.
Okay, Bob.
Jim Harry is assistant managing editor for Golf Plus at Sports Illustrated. Every year, broadcasters eagerly await those preordained moments when culture and tradition align to create a captive audience for television. For many Americans, it's Thanksgiving and, say, football. For many Middle Eastern Muslims, it's Ramadan and miniseries. This month, millions of Muslims around the world are celebrating Ramadan by fasting from sunup to sundown, but at dusk, they gather with their extended families to break their fasts and afterwards, in a post-prandial haze, to watch one of the dozens of miniseries produced in 30 or so installments just for them. Asad Abu Khalil is a political science visiting professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Asad, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with, why Ramadan? There's 330 other TV viewing days. Why does this stuff get concentrated in one brief period?
You have a captive audience, literally. The purpose of these shows are, one, you have during the day people who are fasting and who really want so bad some entertainment to help them pass the day without thinking about food. And this is why commercials tend to shy away from advertising about food and chicken and fries. And the second purpose is, and this is when the serious competition begins, after breaking their fast, they gather around the TV, help in the digestion, and then the next day it all starts anew.
You raise an interesting point, because it's not just like there's one miniseries out there at Ramadan. There's a whole mess of these things. How many exactly?
It is fair to say that an Arab is bombarded with literally tens of new programming on every single day of Ramadan. I mean, the complaint you hear by talking to people, as I did last night to my mother in Beirut, they don't complain about bad programming. They complain about the fact that they just can't keep up. Some good shows sometimes get buried because of the stiff competition.
Now, these series have been around for decades, literally. They used to come primarily out of Egypt, biggest economy, biggest TV production facilities. Is there a big difference between the historical Ramadan series and the ones we're seeing now?
Yes, there's a big difference. In the late 1960s and early 70s, they were only the state TV, and they were very tightly in control of programming. And in the 1990s, with the explosion of the various satellite channels, there is such an intense competition, and everybody is trying to make an imprint. And I think one of the credits should go to the creativity of the various artists, primarily from Syria, who try to go around the narrow parameters of what is allowed, and they try to send a message. It's a very anti-conformist, liberal-minded message about the status of women, about social relations, and of course always about how miserable these Arab governments are.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like I cannot believe my ears, because you don't ordinarily hear those thoughts expressed in the same sentence as from Syria. Not exactly a crucible of free expression in the Mideast, and yet?
Without a doubt, the Syrians have been playing a very pioneering role in the writing, the production, as well as direction of many of these serials. They have a very simple and yet very successful formula. Unlike the past Egyptian and Lebanese serials, which tended to indulge in the portrayal of the high life, the extravagantly rich, they tend to focus on real people, very much like people in the streets of Cairo, Beirut, or Amman, or in Damascus. Unfortunately, this tremendous success is taking place while these people are under such tremendous restrictions. And I even asked 2 years ago the director of Syrian television what they are doing with all these revenues from the sale of the Syrian cereals. He told me that all the money goes to the central bank, that they don't give any of the proceeds to share it with Syrian television.
So there's a number of swirling ironies. I mean, not only that the proceeds from these shows go into the coffers of a very oppressive state, but also that because there isn't a whole lot of outlet for expression in Syria, as I understand it, a lot of very talented people are behind these productions. They're very sophisticated teleliterature, huh?
Extremely sophisticated. They make allegories by referring to past historical eras, but the Arab viewers is not naive, and he and she knows that they are making references to the governments under which Arabs live and suffer.
But do they deal with these other kind of looming issues of Arab life, such as terrorism, such as the question of suicide bombings and so forth? Do these ever come up?
The answer to your question is yes, they do cover these political issues. They don't do it from the same perspective that George W. Bush wants them to cover it, but they cover them. And you find on Egyptian serials as well as in Syrian serials, there is mocking references to Muslim religious fanatics. And there is now a very famous Saudi comedy show that is being shown during Ramadan called Tash now. And the religious fanatics in Saudi Arabia have been up in arms over that show because of the way they mock the fanaticism of many religious fundamentalists in the Middle East.
Well, Assad, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Assad Abu Khalil is a political science visiting professor at the University of California at Berkeley.
Just as Arab broadcasters know that people stay in during Ramadan, American broadcasters assume that people go out on Saturday night. Once a night for testing offbeat and experimental shows, now Saturday is a wasteland of reruns, movies, and college football. Mitch Metcalf is NBC's executive vice president of scheduling. He says that in the cutthroat world of TV real estate, you build your best hotels where or when you can charge the most rent.
If Thursday is Boardwalk, Saturday is Baltic Avenue, it's the lowest viewed night of the week. And most advertisers like to reach people before the weekend, before big buying decisions are made. That's why Thursday is so popular. By Saturday night, a lot of those decisions have been made and viewers have lives, and Saturday night is the night they tend to give television a rest.
If you look at the NBC schedule for October 8th, which I have here, there were three consecutive reruns of My Name is Earl, followed by a rerun of Law and Order, Special Victims Unit. Is it fair to say that everyone has virtually given up on Saturday?
Well, given up is an interesting term. We'd never want to say we give up. But
how about surrender?
Maybe a little closer. We have a very limited number of original episodes to program. We have to prioritize the nights. Saturday, it turns out, is the night that gets left out.
But you do make the point then very well that Saturday seems to have been transformed into a night for promoting the schedule the rest of the week.
Exactly. It's a night for, as we fondly say, repurposing. Using repeats of original episodes. And there's a phenomenon called stacking, and that's putting the same program right after another on Saturday. We also did it with a new show called Surface after the first 2 weeks of the season. And what you see whenever you stack a program is that the ratings tend to build. Whoever you can get at 8 o'clock tends to stick around because they're already invested and already watching, and they can catch more of that particular episode.
And if you build the stack high enough, it becomes a marathon.
Exactly.
So what do you do on a typical Saturday night?
I have a lovely date with my wife. It's a night of rest for a television programmer.
Mitch Metcalf is Executive Vice President for Program Planning and Scheduling at NBC Entertainment. According to the Associated Press, the Saturday night network TV audience has plummeted nearly 40% in the last 5 years. Stephen Stark, author of Glued to the Set, the 60 television shows and events that made us who we are today, says that those who do stay home on Saturday night are largely older, more rural, and poorer than the demographic advertisers now chase. But there was a time, says Stark, when a Saturday night show could corral an audience and advertisers.
Gunsmoke ran on Saturday nights. Gunsmoke was a show that appealed more to rural viewers and poorer viewers, as Westerns did. Bonanza actually premiered on Saturday night. But once they found that they could get a bigger audience with it, that it might transcend the night, so to speak, they moved it to Sunday nights at 9, and then it was the huge hit it was in the mid-60s.
So you're saying that Saturday night has never served up cutting-edge TV, but it did have its own golden age from 1971 to 75. There was All in the Family. That was the number one show in the country on Saturday at 8 o'clock.
Gee, our old lass now ran great. Those were the days.
Why did that show work in that time slot?
Well, it was very much by accident on CBS. All in the Family, with Archie Bunker, created by Norman Lear, was not much of a hit in its first season when it was on during the week, although it was enormously controversial, because could you make a joke out of bigotry? They moved it to Saturday nights at 8, and it got a tremendous audience. But remember, by and large, because the overwhelming number of viewers for that show were more conservative. They agreed with everything he was saying.
We didn't crawl out from under no rocks. We didn't have no tails. We didn't come from monkeys, you atheistic pinko meathead.
Okay, but then it was followed by MASH and by Mary Tyler Moore and the Bob Newhart Show and Carol Burnett. Certainly MASH isn't going to appeal to people who may, I think you're suggesting, be more embracing of the kind of message that Archie Bunker offered.
Well, that's very true. What happened is that Archie Bunker began to draw liberals as well, people who would actually stay home on Saturday nights to watch him, and they built a schedule around him. Actually, somebody wrote right when Mary Tyler Moore came on in the early 70s that she was so in, actually, that it's become especially fashionable to drift into the den at a party or even go home at 9 on a Saturday because you simply must not miss the program. It became must-see viewing, very much like what NBC did in the 80s and 90s on Thursday nights with Seinfeld and Cheers and things like that. And that golden age of Saturday night programming essentially lasted for the better part of a decade. But then in the 80s and 90s, Saturday night reverted to its usual graveyard status. It's not that the shows didn't draw an audience. Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, was an enormously popular show, as was The Love Boat, as was Fantasy Island. But the kind of viewers, again, those shows tended to draw were not the kind that advertisers tend to like because they want younger viewers. They tend to be more susceptible to advertising than older people who are more set in their ways.
And so ditto for the Golden Girls in the 80s and Touched by an Angel in the 90s, you'd say.
They fit the pattern exactly.
But they did manage to create a space for attractive, well-heeled, younger viewers in the 1970s. So why couldn't that happen again?
Well, the networks, first of all, are much more risk-averse because it's a much more cutthroat industry. Having said that, if I were a network executive, everybody's doing one thing, I might try to run a risque show on Saturday and see if I might be able to attract something of an audience. But it would be hard to get advertisers interested in it in the beginning. Some of the biggest hits in the history of television, whether we're talking about Roots or All in the Family and Mary Tyler Moore, attracted an audience because they were willing to try things in a different way, usually, by the way, on the network that it was in last place at the time. When they first went to the networks with Roots, the reason why ABC ran it and the other two wouldn't touch it is they were in third place. And the producer of Roots went to the head of the network and said, look, you're in third place. If Roots doesn't work, you'll still be in third place. So for the network where things aren't working, it might be worth a try.
Okay, Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Stark is a cultural critic whose books include Glued to the Set and his latest, Meet the Beatles.
Hello?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman, our webmaster. He's Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.